Advertisers use a number of different techniques to advertise their goods and services. These can be broadly categorized into two large areas, objective claims and puffery. I'd like to start out with the idea of objective claims. Objective claims, or objective advertising, is advertising based on fact. If you're going to make an objective claim, you need to have the data to back it up. For example, if you're going to claim that your car goes 40 miles per gallon, you better have substantiation or data that you've gathered to back that up. If you're going to claim that there are, 40 essential vitamins and minerals in your cereal, you better have scientific testing to back that up. 4 out of 5 dentists surveyed, you better have done a survey. Essentially, if you're going to make an objective claim, you have to be able to back it up with data. Contrast that with puffery. Puffery is like claims that cannot be backed up with fact, that are pure opinion, like in Chapter 4 in Libel. Coke is better than Pepsi. Or hyperbole. My t-shirt makes me the sexiest woman in all of Southern California. All right, well, how do we measure sexy and what is most sexy? It's information that is selling the sizzle, not the steak. You're selling a lifestyle or an idea here that you cannot really measure. Visa, everywhere you want to be. Coke is it. McDonald's, I'm loving it. Well, what are you loving? It? What's it? A Big Mac? A fries? Whatever. All of that information that's out there that's puffery cannot really be measured. Customers like puffery because it sells them a lifestyle, and advertisers like that too. But if you're looking for objective claims, again, an advertiser who's making an objective claim needs to have data to back that up. Okay? Let me give you some examples of ads that the company thought was puffery that really turned out to be objective claims. That fine young icon there is Professor Wonder. Wonder Bread, that stuff that you ball up and feed to the ducks that has absolutely no nutritional value. Professor Wonder was claiming that Wonder Bread had added calcium and that the calcium would improve children's brain functions and make them remember better. When competitors for Wonder said, well, where's your data for this? They essentially said, well, there are some claims here that calcium improves children's memories. And, that is actually, given, said Wonder. And the competitor said, well, where is your data? Where have you done the experiments that show that if children eat Wonder Bread, their memories are actually better? And what is a good source of calcium? Well, the FTC was not very happy with Wonder Bread's response and said that Interstate Bakeries Corp., which is the maker of Wonder Bread, did not have substantiation for that claim, that bread was a good source of calcium and that children's minds were working better and they could remember things better. And it turned out that the FTC ended up settling with IBC in 2002. Okay, so they were essentially saying that Wonder was making a unsubstantiated claim that they didn't have data for and that they were going to be punished for. Let me give you my favorite example, Walmart. Back in the late 1980s, Walmart's ad slogan was, always the low price, always. Target and Kmart got together and a couple other stores got together and said, well, look, you don't always have the low price. We're sometimes lower. And Walmart said, no, people really think that's puffery. People don't really believe that Walmart always has the lowest prices. Do they? Well, Target and Walmart and the competitors got together and did an experiment of their own. And it turned out that consumers believed that when Walmart said, always the low price, that meant that there was no place else lower. That if you went to Walmart and you picked up a bottle of shampoo, you were getting it cheaper than anywhere else. Okay? So Walmart, when it was faced with this evidence, and the NARB, we'll talk about the NARB in a little bit, their communication that the slogan really meant always the low price, and Walmart doesn't always have the lowest price, Walmart changed its slogan to always low prices, always. Do you see the difference? Taking out the made it less specific to always have the lowest price. Okay, now of course they have that yellow bouncing hair there they did for a while, and I don't even know what their slogan is now. That just goes to show how quickly advertisers change slogans. Okay, let's turn to the unfairness doctrine. I am sure that you can identify with working on a paper until 3 o'clock in the morning, and at 3:10 10 in the morning, you decide to check a source, and you go on Google, and you Google a term, and you go to a website, and all of a sudden, bang, blue screen of death, because you've accidentally clicked on an ad that has come up with a crash on your computer, and you haven't saved until, you know, for the last 4 hours, and you've lost 4 hours of work. You have been subject to an unfair ad. In theory, you could sue under the unfairness doctrine. The unfairness doctrine says that an ad is unfair if three things are true. If the ad causes or is likely to cause substantial consumer injury, I don't know about you, but 4 hours of lost work is substantial enough for me, which is not reasonably avoided by the consumers themselves. You didn't know that when you clicked on that ad by accident that it was going to crash your computer. And there is no countervailing benefit. You didn't even want to click on the ad, and you certainly didn't want the product that the ad was advertising. Theoretically, you could sue and have a good case under the unfairness doctrine. Now, would you win? They would raise some sort of affirmative defenses, of course, and you never want to be the test case. But examples of these are internet trick called mouse trapping. Mouse trapping takes place when browser back buttons are disabled, or when you close one browser window and another three pop open. Porn sites use this a lot. I know you guys don't ever go to porn sites, but I do research on porn sites, and I've seen when this happens. You close one browser window and another four pop open. Or your back button is disabled so you can't get out. That is called mouse trapping, and in theory, it is illegal. Why do these websites keep happening? Well, it's because the FTC only has so many bodies to sue. Okay? But in theory, the unfairness doctrine would protect you if you were able to sue under it. Okay. The advertising industry does one thing very, very well, and that is self-regulate. Okay? The industry realizes that it is bound by the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission is a government bureaucracy, and government bureaucracies move slowly. But the advertising industry moves very fast, so there's a disconnect there. What the advertising industry did in the 1960s and 70s is created a self-regulatory setup that is unparalleled in any other communications industry. It's really nicely done. The major benefits to advertisers who decide to participate in this, and it's voluntary, are their faster resolution of complaints. There are no or fewer lawyers involved. You don't get the law involved. There are no penalties, legal fees, etc. It really is a much better way of dealing with disputes between advertisers. The Better Business Bureau is part of this organization, and it's the National Advertising Review Council. It's also made up of three additional bodies. The National Advertising Division, or the NAD, the National Advertising Review Unit, or CARU, the National Advertising Review Board, or NARB. The only two we're going to focus on for purposes of this chapter is NAD and NARB. The companies need not participate, but most of them do. It's voluntary, and they pay in a certain amount of money to participate, but by and large they participate because that leaves the government out of it. If they can resolve their issues before it gets to the FTC, everybody keeps a lot more of their money and time. Okay? How does it work? The NAD monitors national ads, so this is primarily about national advertising, and it also takes complaints from competitors. They watch for misleading, deceptive, or false advertising. They do an investigation, and if they find the advertiser to be in violation, they ask the advertiser to take action to correct the problems. The advertiser doesn't necessarily have to take the recommendation of the NAD. They can appeal to the NARB. The NARB is sort of the review board, the appeals court, if you will. Most of the time, they tend to uphold the NAD's findings, but not all the time. And most advertisers decide to go with the recommendations of the NAD and NARB. The compliance, in fact, is nearly 100%. It's much faster and much cheaper than getting the FTC involved. However, if an advertiser ignores the recommendations of the NAD and NARB, the organizations will review and refer the issue to the FTC for legal action, okay, or other appropriate agencies, sometimes the Food and Drug Administration. Let me give you some examples. A 1994 case of Kraft General Foods. Kraft General Foods makes Bullseye barbecue sauce, and they advertised in taste test after taste test, the big bold taste of Bullseye tastes the best. This annoyed Hunt's, who makes Hunt's barbecue sauce. They said, where's your data for this? Okay, well, Kraft said, we've got data here. Here's a 1989 taste test, and we tested your barbecue sauce against our barbecue sauce, and more people liked our barbecue sauce. What's your problem? Hunt said, ah, but did you test it against our new formulation of barbecue sauce? And Kraft said, no, but that's not shouldn't be that much of a problem, should it? The NAD and NARB took a look at this and said, well, you have kind of old data here. Why don't you pull this advertising campaign, Kraft, until you can test your barbecue sauce against Hunt's newest barbecue sauce? Kraft said, okay, pulled their advertising campaign, and everybody was happy. Here's another example, near and dear to my heart, Starbucks. If you go to Starbucks today and you buy their apple, hot apple beverage, it is not called caramel apple cider because of a 2007 complaint by some people in New England. Let me explain. Starbucks started out advertising caramel apple cider. Some people love it. I tend to prefer coffee. It's a steamed apple beverage that's got cinnamon and caramel in it. But people in New England were confused and annoyed by this. In New England in particular, the Better Business Bureau pointed out, a lot of people say that apple cider is different from apple juice. Starbucks said, well, wait a minute here. The FDA has no difference, shows no difference between apple cider and apple juice. It's just a regional usage. NAD and NARB took a look at this and said, well, that may be so, but why don't you stop advertising caramel apple cider anyway to avoid consumers in the Northeast getting confused? Starbucks said, fine. And now if you buy their steamed apple beverage, it is called caramel apple spice. Such is the power of the NAD and NARB. All right. Let's turn to a situation where an advertiser ignored the NAD and NARB. Grey Goose Vodka. Yum. Nothing not to like about Grey Goose except their advertising. Let me explain. It's brought into the country by Sidney Frank Importing, which is out of Minneapolis. And that ad right there, that blue ad there, is an advertisement that talks about how Grey Goose won a Beverage Testing Institute Award in 1998 with a score of 96 out of 100. They listed a bunch of other vodkas, including Belvedere Vodka, which only got 74 out of 100 points that year. Belvedere brought a complaint to the NAD and NARB saying, well, Grey Goose is running this ad, but we did better in later years. We didn't do so well in 1998, but in later years, we've been doing a lot better. Grey Goose said, well, you know, we actually say that it's a 1998 comparison. We don't see that there's a problem for this, and we like this ad. NARB and NAD said, well, you know, you might as well pull it anyway because consumers have the potential of being confused. Grey Goose said, we're not pulling it, and it ended up going to court. Grey Goose did win, however, because the court found that there was no deception, even though the print was a little small and the information was a little dated. I have not seen any appeal on this. Doesn't stop me from drinking Grey Goose, however. All right. Now, let's finally turn to the idea of spam. When I opened my Gmail account the last time I opened it, I found out that I could buy a college diploma for $300. Why are we going to school anyway? I was able to buy a device to make my penis larger or to make it hard longer. The fact that I'm a woman didn't seem to bother the spammers. I was able to find out that I could buy a Rolex watch spelled R0L3X, etc., etc. Spam is unsolicited commercial email, and it clogs up all of our inboxes. Congress has inboxes too, and they're worried about the potential of spam to really be a problem for consumers. All right? On any given day, we are a member of 22 or 25 different mailing lists. I always suggest to students that they don't hit delete on those. They don't use the unsubscribe button that's supposed to be at the bottom of these spam things, because even if you're removed off one mailing list, your live email address is added onto a bunch of others, and you could get a whole bunch more spam. At least 36 states, however, are worried as well and have anti-spam laws, including California. In California, you're supposed to, if you're a spammer, put ADV colon at the beginning of every subject line. I don't know about you, but I've never seen a single spam one that had that in there. You're supposed to give away to be removed from the list, although, as I said, I recommend that you don't do it. And all normal advertising rules have to be followed as well. No deceptive or unfair advertising. However, email spam started to be such a big problem that a federal law was passed in 2004. The 2004 law is called, and I'm not making this up, the CAN-SPAM Act. It stands for Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing Act. Congress loves acronyms. The rules are supposed to be as follows. Unsolicited commercial email messages are supposed to be labeled somehow as advertisements. Ha ha ha. There are supposed to be opt-out directions. Most of them do that, but again, you get added to another mail list. There's supposed to be a physical address for a sender. There's supposed to be undeceptive subject lines. For example, there's not supposed to be a subject line that says RE colon your message, because RE means regarding, and it's standard that that comes back when you're writing back to somebody. So, for example, if I sent you an email and you sent it back to me, it would say RE whatever, and I might be inclined to open it thinking that I had sent to you first and you were sending me back. All right? The FTC does not have a do not email list, although they can establish one. Their rationale was that, can you imagine if that got hacked? State laws are still in effect. They have to be modified to fall into line with the federal act because of federal supremacy laws. And, of course, it took effect in January of 2004. There have been a number of different settlements, most recently a 2010 Florida company settlement for $2.9 million under this act. They were found liable for having spammed and under breaking the CAN-SPAM Act. There have been a couple other court cases that have happened as well. I expect that we will continue to see additional companies falling afoul of this law as the years go on. Congratulations, my friends, you have made it to the end of the semester.